Well, my schedule during the spring months oftentimes is a little more erratic than usual because I'm on travel. It's just down in the Southwest for a couple of weeks, remembering what the sun looks like. And yeah, I grew up in southern Arizona in the Sonoran Desert, and so now that I'm retired, every winter I go down there and for a couple of weeks and kind of reconnect with the desert. But yes, please, Kendall.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention I've been looking at the Eco Dharma website. Spring retreats are coming up. This is the time to start signing up because they're out there.
Yes, yeah, it's a good point. Eco Dharma Retreats, Rocky Mountain Eco Dharma Retreat Center, RMERC. You can just go to their website and see what the offerings are that they have. And they're actually, they're doing outreach now. They want to have basically a teacher's council meeting for all the sanghas in the Front Range to say, basically have a kind of a conference or a get together so we can focus on how to most effectively program the retreats that are being held there to meet the needs of the people in the Front Range Sanghas, and so to kind of coordinate a little bit better, because their focus really is on using nature as a teacher and deepening your Dharma practice, and so most of their programs are oriented around that. So how to more effectively address those needs is something that's definitely an ongoing focus for sure. Thank you. So, the Dharma Wheel this is actually an announcement. The Dharma Wheel is a depiction of the Eightfold Path, the pathway to liberation, to self, deep, selfless peace of mind, as the Buddha taught it. And eight spokes, okay, divided into three groups. One group of three is called the meditative factors. The meditative factors are concentration, and here's where the word samadhi gets a little confusing, because the meditative factors, all three of them collectively, are referred to as samadhi. But samadhi in a narrower sense is also one of the three. So samadhi or concentration is one of the meditative factors. Effort, wise effort, is another of the meditative factors. And right mindfulness is the third meditative factor. The two wisdom factors, right understanding, right intention, collectively called panya in Pali, and then the fruition of the meditative factors and the wisdom factors in terms of how we speak, how we act, and how we live our lives. Sila. Okay. For this evening and for the next two times I teach, I want to focus on those three meditative factors. Okay. And we're going to kind of make our way around the Dharma Wheel, right? We're going to focus for my next three teachings, and I'll put an announcement out on the listserv with the dates and all that. I'll also include a link to the guided meditations of Anali over monk whose practice we did this evening, so you can do that on your own if you want to. So at any rate, this is the first of three talks and discussions that we can have on these three meditative factors. And we'll be putting the word out on that. Okay. So the awkwardness that comes along with using an icon like the Dharma Wheel, okay, is that it kind of gives the impression that you do each one of these things in sequence, right? First you develop some concentration, and you make sure your effort's solid, and then along comes the mindfulness, and then that sets the grounds for the arising of the wisdom factors, and then that makes it, then you start to get insight into whether your intended words and deeds are going to be helpful or unhelpful. But in fact, it's not really that linear at all. Okay. One of the beneficial uses of the icon is to remember that a wheel can't function properly if all the spokes are not of roughly the same strength. So those factors are all important, and no one is more or less important than the other. They're mutually reinforcing. Another important aspect of the wheel, at least in this depiction, is that the hub is empty. Everything arises out of that sense of emptiness or not self. But it's not like first you do one and then the other. It's a highly interactive system. You know, one of the similes that's occurred to me for these eight factors, aspects of the Eightfold Path, it's kind of like the endocrine system in our bodies, you know, the ductless glands, and what various of them here and there around the body excrete certain kinds of hormones directly into the bloodstream. And they do different things. You know, like insulin helps us digest sugars, and various of these, you know, endocrine glands, you know, the thyroid and the parathyroid and various of the others excrete these hormones that help us stay in balance, that help the body function in an integrated way, okay, and that contribute collectively to the body's ability to stay alive. Okay. It's very much the way it is with each of these aspects of the Eightfold Path. If you get really hung up on just the arcane subcategories of doctrine, you know, in Buddha Dharma, you know, and you're just really kind of plowing into the wisdom factors and not doing much else, things can get pretty out of whack. The heart can really dry up. The ability for the mind to go into deep states of relaxation is compromised because you're stuck in your head. If you take on the precepts of non-harming, of not stealing, of generosity, of truth-telling, of integrity in the expression of your sexual energy, in the maintaining clear-mindedness, you know, and nothing else, then that can get a little whacked out as well, because it's not base, it's not deeply rooted in meditative experience, and it's not so rooted in an understanding of the intentions that give rise to your actions in the first place. So these things really all kind of function in an integrative way and support each other. Okay. So, for instance, if any one of these is weak or absent, then it's kind of like if you're, you know, your pancreas shuts down or something, you know, that some vital system is out of whack, is not functioning as it should. It's not functioning in a way that maintains the dynamic homeostasis of the body. Okay. So as we go through each of these, as we look at them more carefully, that's really important to remember, okay, that we're looking at each of these in and of itself, but we're also looking at them in context. You know, there needs to be a certain amount of samadhi, of the ability to see clearly and calmly, okay, in order for mindfulness to be able to occur. You know, if the mind is really muddied all the time, then it's not really possible to see what's going on in the mind. Okay. You can have mindfulness going on, kind of like a security camera that sees everything coming and going. But if that's all that's happening, then it doesn't feed the wisdom very well. And it doesn't get deep enough or microscopic enough to really see what's going on in the mind in the absence of some samadhi, some calmness, some concentration. So with that in mind, I want to offer a few comments about the importance of samadhi in this, it's small s, concentration. And then begin for us to kind of share what the nature of our experience was when we did this practice. And the intention of this practice is to foster or to cultivate samadhi or concentration. So one of the things I like about the writings of Anālaya, this monk and scholar, is that he's really precise about the etymology of the words in the Pali language, which is to say, what are the origins of those words? Where do they come from? Okay, what is their root meaning? And then how does that provide more insight into what it was the Buddha was trying to get across when he used those words? So here's a passage he writes about the word samadhi. The noun samadhi is related to the verb samadhati, which means to put together or to collect, such as when one collects wood to kindle a fire. Samadhi thus stands for collecting oneself in the sense of composure or unification of mind. Okay. So I think that probably each of us has our own, what you might call like a default setting, what the mind usually does when you're mindful enough to watch what the mind's doing, but you're not mind, the mindfulness of the samadhi isn't strong enough to keep it from flying off in this direction or the other. So when I'm sitting and settled in, a little bit calm, and start watching what the mind's doing, it's flying off in all directions. Mostly it goes into the future. Planning this, planning that, Something as mundane as what to shop for at the market this week, something as grandiose as whether to, go on a 3-year retreat in Tibet. Not going to happen, at least not this lifetime. But it's always in the future. It's like how when we drive a car, if we're going to drive a car safely, the mind really needs to be doing two things. It's kind of a split screen, right? You need to be aware of what you're doing, how you're controlling the vehicle in the moment. What the gauges are telling you, which pedals your feet are on, operating the turn signal, that sort of thing. So there's one aspect of it that really requires you to be very present in the car at the same time. The other half of the mind, though, if you're driving safely, is always in the future. It's always about 10 or 20 or 30 seconds or more out in front, depending on how fast you're going. Okay. I mean, it's really quite remarkable when we're driving, everything that the mind is up to. Because there's like this cone of consciousness out in front of us where we're running all of these calculations about which cars are around me, how fast are they going? Is that person whose name shall go unmentioned about to cut me off? what's happening? When I was learning to drive, my dad just said, just always remember, you always want to drive like the other driver's a damn fool, and then you basically expect the unexpected, right? Don't take anything for granted. And at the same time, you need to be moving with the flow. You need to be able to apprehend or expect the possibility of something happening right in front of you that you need to be able to adjust for if it does, okay? So in order to drive safely, some portion of the consciousness always needs to be in the future. The problem that tends to happen for a lot of us, I think, especially the ones whose default setting is planning mode, is that we wind up living in the future most of the time. We're sitting here in the present, but we're thinking about what we're going to do next. Or we're thinking about what may happen out there next, over which we have no control, and how we're going to respond to it if it does. Okay. If there's stuff that's recently gone on or that's gone on a long time ago in our lives that has had a real impact, an emotional impact on how we see the world now, how we interact with the world now, then that piece of the mind lives in the past, you know. The mind in the present moment is conjuring the past. You know, whether it's a pleasant memory or an unpleasant one, someone who was kind to you and helped put you on the Dharma path, someone who was really nasty to you and made you feel bad and you feel bad about them as a result. So the mind spends so much time anywhere but here. So one of the kind of revolutionary things that the Buddha came up with was to focus on the importance of training the mind to be in the present moment. You know, the Buddha said, we become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. What he meant when he said that, there's different translations of it, but what he meant when he said that is we are conjuring up our own reality on a moment-by-moment basis. You know, that which we take to be how things are is more than anything else a matter of how we decide things are based on our past experience, okay, or our values or how we've been treated or something like that. And what we're essentially doing is projecting our state of mind. You know, we see things not as they are, but as we are. We're projecting our state of mind onto the environment and deciding that's how things are. And what the Buddha said is that when we live that way, we are basically hypnotizing ourselves. We are taking whatever state of mind that we happen to be inhabiting at the time for an objective and understanding and interpretation of how the world is, period. When in fact, he says, it's really nothing more than a movie of your own making. And you wrote the script, you're directing it, you're acting in it, you know, if you've got some soundtrack going, you know, you've got that happening as well, right? But what he's trying to get us to do when we do these meditation practices is wake up from the movie. You know, that's why doing a practice like the one we did this evening can feel kind of tedious and boring. You know, like when you're getting bad TV reception and that which looks like it's clear and continuous, all of a sudden the signal gets goofy and everything depixelates, right? And so you were real sucked in, and then all of a sudden, you know, the entertainment's gone, and it's just you and the screen full of colored squares, you know? Bummer, you know? When you become deeply mindful, you are depixelating your movie. You know, you are relaxing in this, oh, damn, you know? Wasn't a very good movie, but at least it was kind of entertaining, and now I'm just here, you know, and I'm watching the mind try to, you know, paste all the squares back together again, start the next movie. But meanwhile, here I am in the present. You know, I'm using that example of being a little bored because sometimes when I do that practice, that's what happens for me. But I am interested in hearing for anyone else who would like to share their experience of doing this sweeping practice tonight. What was it like? You know, what maybe did you find useful? What did you find irritating? Yeah, please, Andy.
I guess one thing, not exactly on track, but sort of on track, and that is I've gotten used to seeing this movie all the time. And when the movie's not there, I get worried.
Yeah, right. Because, good point. Andy says when the movie's not playing, it gets a little worried, you know, because we take the movie to be who we are. Like, wow, if there's no more movie happening right now, maybe there's no me. And that means you're getting close, you know? Because that's where the Buddha's taken us when he says that, you know, that we literally make ourselves up as we go along. And when we settle the mind to the point where we're not doing that, you know, we're getting, number one, we're getting very close to the empty space. know. And the closer we get, on the one hand, the more attainable or understandable the realization is that maybe not self is a real not thing, you know, that it actually is a state of being that can be experienced. And along with that almost tantalizing realization, there can be really deep concern. You know, if I let the mind get that calm, you know, where do I go? You know, maybe I'll depixelate. Yeah, please.
I kind of did depixelate. I thought there should have been a conclusion at the end, and I had my own, and I had dust at the end. And I don't know how weird that is, but there you go.
I had a similar experience when the way I've been using his guided meditations last about a half an hour each, and so on mornings when I've got pretty much time to sit, what I'll do is I'll settle into my sitting posture and close my eyes, put on one of these talks, and then just listen to it, do the guided meditation, whether it's a sweeping one or something else, and then all of a sudden he stops talking, and it's like, oh. Oh, it's like I was standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon, and all of a sudden there's no more rim. It's like, whoa. But the reason that experience is possible is because the mind has become so calm, you know, so lacking in activity. So in the sense that, I mean, the way that the reason the word, the translation concentration is not great is because you get this feeling that's like cramming everything into a little box or something, like concentrate or extract of this, that, or the other thing. When the sense of it is much more like what Analayo says in that passage. He said, it's just a gathering together of that which was scattered. It's a gathering together of thoughts of the past. It's a gathering together of thoughts of the future and plans for the future. It's bringing the scattered consciousness together in one place at one time. And the Buddha found that the most skillful and effective means of doing that was starting off with the body. And in Analayo's teaching and also in the Buddha's, he said the reason we do this is because, along with thoughts of the future and thoughts of the past and all of our daily activities and whatnot, we come to identify in a very extreme way with this body. You know, this body is who I am, right? And what this meditation suggests, you know, if you can envision the flesh and the connective tissue and the bones and all of those things together, it can kind of begin to have a sort of a depersonalizing effect, right? You know, it's like, oh, well, everyone else here is kind of the same, right? Skin, flesh, bones, right? All mammals, same thing. Skin, flesh, bones. When the Buddha taught the four elements meditation, and I was getting at the same thing. You know, you're aware of the breathing, of the salivating, of the pulsating, you know, of the touching. And it's just these sensations of this physical entity being in the world and nothing more. It's training the mind to become comfortable with not conjuring self, essentially. And that is a very intimate, and it's a very tender, and as Andy was pointing out, sometimes a kind of a scary prospect. Because it is our mind informed by Buddha Dharma inviting us to contemplate the possibility that whoever we think we are, as the Buddha said, it is never thus, you know. Because in the very thinking, this is who I am, it's like a sort of ego kind of stepping outside and saying, this is who I am. I am this body. This body has this color skin. This body has this kind of complexion. This body is this age. This body is yada, 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 right? And the invitation is to enter the center of the wheel. See how the wheel's all around? There's the spokes, and there's the structure. There's the thing that's here I am spinning along through life. And yet there's this quiet, still space in the middle. And when we train the mind to be that calm, that space becomes available in a way that it's usually not. Okay. And then from that space, it becomes possible to recognize and to investigate what's going on in the discursive mind, you know, in a much more careful way, you know. And in a kinder way. In these teachings, you find teachings about samadhi, and you find teachings about what's called sama-samadhi. And sama-samadhi means right concentration. That's one of the translations of sama. Again, not so great a one, at least for our purposes in the West. Because when they're teaching, in the classic teachings of the Eightfold Path, you know, right concentration, right view, right mindfulness, it immediately triggers right and wrong. Right and wrong, Ten Commandments, you know. I'm doing it wrong, I'm a bad yogi. You know, I'm perverting the Dharma because it's wrong view, it's wrong. And sama doesn't mean that. Sama means in accordance with the path. Sama refers to intention. You're concentrating the mind for the purpose of allowing clarity of mind for insight. You're concentrating the mind for the purpose of allowing the arising of generosity, for allowing the arising of wisdom. It's the practice of samadhi in the service of becoming free. Okay. So when you hear the words like right mindfulness or right samadhi, that's what it's trying to get at. More and more alternative interpretations are being experimented, something like wise samadhi, you know, wise concentration, or skillful, as distinguished from unskillful, as a way to try to get away from that unfortunate kind of dualistic connotation. So that's helpful for all eight of the spokes. But you can have, you know, like somebody, like a professional poker player, can develop amazing samadhi, you know, reading cards, trying to figure out who's holding what, how to play the hand they've got, whether to take a draw or not. They're the whole time, you know, they're playing the whole game, or a chess master, right, for instance, you know, a sniper in a war, tremendous concentration to, you know, blow somebody's head off, right? Not so skillful. So it invites us to reflect back on why it is that I'm really trying to calm the mind. There's a whole realm of samadhi practice called the meditative absorptions, or the jhanas, you know. And they're deep states of calmness that kind of liberate energy in the mind that allows for the arising of joy and sometimes a certain sense of euphoria or very deep calmness. The Buddha said it can be very useful to develop those qualities of mind if they're available to you, because they really calm and settle the mind and make it possible to do insight meditation practice at a more profound level. If, on the other hand, you're developing these concentrative powers mostly because you want to get high, you know, or you want to be able to brag to your friends or whatever, or as an alternative to being bored while you sit, that's unskillful. You know, that's unskillful concentration. The other problem he said with them is that it's easy to get hooked. You can really get to the place where you crave to, you know, one or another of these states of mind, or cling to one if you attain it. He said that then it becomes a big problem, because you're developing concentrative practices for the wrong reasons, you know, when in fact it's in the service of mindfulness, which then allows progression toward freedom. So, more questions or reflections on what anyone's experience may have been in doing this sweeping practice? Yeah, please.
It was nice that it ended on the floor. You know, your bones in contact with the floor, because then you could just slip into the earth element, which is the bones.
Yes.
In the body.
Right.
Yeah. So you're kind of out while being in at the same time.
Yeah, I appreciate that aspect about it as well. I you know, feel much better ending the meditation kind of being grounded than I do stuck in my head.
Yeah, well, Peter, as far away from your head as it
is. Yeah. Anyone else's experience? Or any questions about samadhi, relationship between concentration and mindfulness?
I found it difficult at times to stay with me. My tendency was to try to race ahead and finish the body.
Yes. Yes. Right.
I had to focus on listening to you and slowing down.
Right. I appreciate your saying that. You're saying that the mind has this tendency to kind of, let's rip through this and get it over with, you know? But when in fact, as you correctly point out, part of the training of the mind is learning how to slow down. Bhante Gunaratana, he talks about these practices. He says, you know, insight, you know, shamatha and vipassana, he says, the effect is to slow down the rate of mental activity at the same time you accelerate the rate of awareness, you know, the ability to see deeply into each moment of experience as it comes along. Now, it accelerates the rate of attention, I guess you might say. And so the more slowly you go, the more you're able to slow down this, you know, the speediness of the mind, the more deeply you're able to delve into what it is that the mind is up to at any given point in time. You know, Sekhi Rinpoche, the Tibetan Dzogchen meditation teacher, sometimes uses a simile of a mala, which is a bracelet made of beads. And in some practice traditions, people wear those, and then they, if they're doing mantra, you know, then they count on the beads how many times they've done the mantra. And he said that the practice of mindfulness and shamatha and vipassana, of calmness, you know, samadhi, vipassana together, it's like what you're doing is loosening the string on the bracelet, you know, on the mala, because then it's like the beads had each been tightly tied together, and then what you're doing is loosening it so that you begin to see spaces between each moment of mental activity. That there's the activity, there's the thought or the sensation or whatever, and then there's this space in between. And then the next thing comes up, and then there's a space in between. And again and again. And so, and this, and you can, when things slow down for you and you're meditating, sometimes you can kind of note that happening. It's like you really get into a calm state, and one of the similes that's used is like you're sitting by the edge of a river, and then it's like a bubble in a stream, you know, something floats by, you know, or a branch or a twig or dead rat or something, and it just floats by, and then it's gone, and then it's just the river again. And then something else may come along, you know. And the calmer the mind gets, then the fewer these objects seem to come along, or when they do come along, you can note them very quickly, and you don't attach a story to them. I wonder what happened to the rat, you know. or basically the mind just drops into this place where it's simply observing the flow without kind of getting drawn into it in a kind of a dramatic way. Yeah, oh, please.
I had a similar experience of rushing ahead and then having to concentrate on what you were asking us to do. And I realized that usually we think of our body as this whole unit. We don't think of the skin or the organs or the skeleton. And so, I realize we have gratitude for all these aspects of our form that enable us to be present, to be on the earth, you know, the skeleton and all the lives that go up to make up our body, and how we are so grateful that we are participating in the earth in this way.
Yes, thank you. And the trillions and trillions of bacteria that we play host to, you know, that make it possible for us to digest our food and do all kinds of other things. On occasion doing this, there's also been, for me, this sense of absolute, like you say, a sense of absolute wonderment. It's like, my gracious, it's like you're going inside, and yet at the same time, it's as if you have expanded into the universe. Like there's this incredible universe within us. You know, all these things that are going on, you know, all these electrons, you know, synapses, the nerves firing all the time all over the place. You know, and it's a really good thing that we don't have to be conscious of our breathing. You know, I mean, if breathing was volitional, half of us would be on the floor now, you know. But if you forget to breathe and you keel over, but the body's taking care of that. You know, it's setting a respiratory rate commensurate with the needs of the body in the moment. You know, and there are all these other things going on of which we really aren't aware, and yet they all combine to make it possible for us to sit here and have this conversation. Just remarkable. Yeah, please.
This is one of my struggles in my meditation, is talk about your appreciation for the body, but some of us have pain, and our bodies aren't doing what it's supposed to do, and trying to address that through meditation is not always successful, at least not for me.
Yes, thank you, Kendall. I appreciate you saying that. And other Sangha members have brought this up as well, that there's this kind of dichotomy between what you hear Buddha Dharma is supposed to be about and what you're supposed to attain, you know, peace of mind, deep acceptance of things as they are and whatnot. So it feels like, you know, at the kind of the sort of self-help level that is supposed to make everything better, You know, it's supposed to make it so they're, you know, well, the Buddha talked about, you know, cessation of dukkha, you know, freedom from suffering as well. Damn, you know, I signed up for this, but I'm not experiencing freedom from suffering. What is going on here, right? And then at some point after we've been practicing a while, we finally get around to reading the fine print, you know? Oh, darn. It doesn't say here that the physical suffering is going to go away. You know, it basically what it says is we inhabit these bodies and bodies suffer. It's their nature. The body can feel ecstasy and joy and absolute delight in being alive on this earth, you know. And the body can hurt. The body can hurt a lot. You know, as can the mind. You know, we can be confronted, whether it's minor aches and pains or a more major, ongoing, chronic condition that causes there to be very significant dukkha, very significant physical dissatisfaction with things as they are. You know, and for anyone that lives with chronic, ongoing pain, I have a friend who had extremely severe, crippling arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis. She could barely move. Mm-hmm. She was in excruciating pain almost all the time. You know, and I could see how it was kind of draining her life essence, you know, her soul or whatever passes for one in Buddhism, that she was feeling spiritually burdened and drained as well. And that's where the Dharma comes in. Because if you read a few more clauses down in the contract, it says it doesn't make the physical pain go away. It provides you with the the means whereby to fundamentally renegotiate or change your relationship to your existence in this physical body. Okay. So as we do this sweeping, for instance, you know, we become more accepting of the body as it is, whatever it is that's going on. And we recognize, just as the Buddha said, you know, that this body, being a compounded thing, is subject to decay, to disease, to infirmity, and then ultimately to death. And so the real jewel in the lotus, the real depth of understanding of what it means to be free of dukkha is learning how to be free of any resistance to things as they are, including pain in the body. Okay. It's difficult to do because the way the nervous system works, the ability to feel pain is a really important system. You know, it's every aspect of the body that has nerve endings telling the brain, we're in trouble here. Something's wrong. Something is not like it's supposed to be. You should do something about it. You know, you should make it better. And if it's something minor, like, you know, an animal bite or, you know, some kind of trauma or something, we see something's happened, and basically it can be very, you know, it's life-saving, you know. It's why we're still around as a species, because we experience pain and we're able to do something about it, skillful about it in a hurry, to help us make it through. That's what the system is for. But the system is also reporting the same signals when it's suffering some condition that the mind can't do anything about. Okay. And so when the Buddha is saying, when you are confronted with physical suffering or mental suffering and mental affliction, okay, that you realize that you don't have the power to make go away. You can spend the rest of your life trying to make something go away that isn't going to go away. Or you can fundamentally renegotiate your relationship with that experience. You can learn how to gradually open to and relax yourself into things as they are rather than as you wish they were. And that is where the freedom begins to become possible. And it can take a long time. That's why we call it practice. But that's what the Buddha meant about freedom from suffering. You know, it's freeing the mind from its relationship to the suffering. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. Gloria.
I was just thinking that one of the things you find in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the promises. It's one of my favorite parts. For some reason, I can't remember all of them, but one of them I remember is losing the fear of financial insecurity. It doesn't say you lose financial insecurity. You may remain as whatever financial insecurity you have, but you lose the negative emotions.
Yes. Right.
I found that with this practice too.
Very much so. The misapprehension that a lot of us come to the Dharma with is that, you know, just like we can wish away physical suffering, we can wish away afflictive emotions. You know, if I'm a good yogi, then I shouldn't be afraid. If I'm a good yogi, then I shouldn't be angry. If I'm a good yogi, no, fill in the blank. When in fact, what the Buddha is saying is that thought is the source of suffering. Judging yourself negatively in the moment is in fact the source of dukkha. You know, that inner voice that says you're not okay as you are. Most of us grew up with that voice. You know, there is this, I watched this film this last week Free Solo. It was a documentary about the first person to ever free climb El Capitan in Yosemite Valley. Never been done before. Most days, most people who climb El Cap, you know, it takes them several days and they have these sling hammocks and they use a lot of protection and takes them a couple of 3 days. Did it in less than 4 hours. And he did it with no protection at all. And he was being filmed by this crew that knew they were either going to film a success climbing El Capitan or they were going to be filming him falling to his death. And he was interviewed at various times in the film. One of the interviews that I found so poignant was when he was talking about his growing up. And he said that both of his parents were absolute obsessive perfectionists. That nothing the kids did was ever quite good enough. That they were constantly being subjected to criticism for not measuring up, for not doing as well as their parents thought they ought to be doing. And he said, I spent most of my childhood living in a bottomless pit of self-loathing. And it was like, out of that came this drive, this need to do something that no one else in the world had ever done. You know, this drive to succeed or die trying, you know, doing that. And so on the one hand, I thought it was very insightful that, you know, that was kind of the energy that made it possible for him to conquer his fears, you know, and do that climb. And then there was another aspect of me that just said, was thinking, how sad, you know, to live his life in a constant state of dukkha, a constant state of striving, you know, to be better, to do basically the impossible, you know, and that conditioning actually came at a very high price, you know, and he did do something absolutely remarkable, you know, there's no two ways about it.
I wonder what his mental state was after he accomplished that, you know, if there was a shift there or not.
It's a very interesting question.
Did you get any insight from you?
They didn't take it much beyond his accomplishment, but I think that could be an equally interesting story. What do you do when you've accomplished that final goal that you've set for yourself? What else is there to do?
And you've always felt insufficient, and then you do something like that.
Right. He said, and he said another thing. He'd been in the longest term relationship he'd ever been in his life, you know, at the time, and it still seemed to be a healthy ongoing relationship. And he was saying, well, he said, my girlfriend, my significant other, she says all she really wants out of life is to be happy and cozy. And he said, great things are never done by people who only want to be happy and cozy. And I was saying, wow, you know, I feel a little bit more like the girlfriend. Happy and cozy. Sounds pretty good. But, you know, and he was also very upfront, getting back to your original question, Gloria, about fear. That it was ever present, except when it wasn't. You know, he would note it and then go back to the issue at hand, which is, how do I get from here to there? You know, there were like maybe something like over 2,000 moves involved in that climb, and he mapped out every one of them. You know, he had notes on every move he was going to make, including the most dangerous ones that he'd fallen off before doing when he was roped in. So talk about samadhi, you know. And the thing about the fear, it was there when it was there, and it wasn't there when it wasn't there. What made it possible for him to do that is what makes it possible for us to host fear in a skillful way, right? So when we talk about courage, you know, certainly in my experience as a combat veteran, and I think probably for him too, it's not the absence of fear. It's the presence of faith and equanimity in the presence of fear. So whether it's our spiritual practice or his spiritual practice, which is climbing, basically, because he lives in the moment, you know, incredible samadhi, you know. Yeah, so it's noticing fear comes, goes, but then having faith in your own abilities and having that sense of equanimity, of being gathered, you know. He was always having to think two or three moves ahead. How do I position myself to, but at the same time is very much in the moment, you know, as he moves one foot, one hand. Same exact thing for us, you know. It's like you were saying, sure, you're broke. You don't know if you're gonna make the rent, you know, you're not on the best of terms with your boss or whatever. There's that fear. It's a well-grounded fear, you know, you need to be, you know, feel like you're safe and, you know, well taken care of. There's a teaching that we'll get to sometime, not tonight since we're out of time, but Samvega, and it's sometimes translated as anxiety, sometimes as fear, sometimes as urgency, but it's things that we are made anxious by, and one of them is that, it's lack of food or shelter, you know, concerns about personal safety. You know, all the stuff at the bottom of the Maslowian hierarchy, needs hierarchy, right? And the Buddha says those are naturally arising things. They arise because we're in this body, and the body wants to be cared for. So it's a natural aspect of being who we are in this world. And it's not something that you should spend your life in aversion to, because feeling fearful is every bit as natural as, you know, slicing your finger with a knife. You know, it happens. It's a form of mental pain, right? So it's not that we should try to avoid it or make sure it doesn't happen. It's how do we relate to it in a way that doesn't distort our lives, that doesn't keep us from being free. You know, there's a Spanish gypsy proverb that says, a life lived in fear is a life half lived. Well, let's settle in for just one last moment. Living in joy and in health, though subject to affliction. Live in joy and in peace, even among those who are troubled. Live in joy and in love, even among those who hate. Look within, be still, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way. Thanks for coming around and join together outside to choose your walking route if you want to.